All right, it's September 8th, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. Today I'm interviewing Early Knowles here in the Mansfield Library. Mr. Knowles, I was hoping you could start out by talking a little bit just about your personal and educational background and what brought you to Missoula and the University of Montana.
Okay. Well, I was born in southwestern Michigan along the shores of Lake Michigan. I'm one of seven children, and went to school in Michigan, went to school in Illinois, and my first professional job was in a military school in central Missouri. And I was a librarian there without formal library training. And because of that, the institution that I was working at, which is no longer in operation now, was interested in providing me opportunities to work on a library degree. So that allowed me to go to summer school at the University of Illinois in Champaign. And so after 3 years at the military school, I decided it was a good time to leave that and concentrate on my master's degree. So I applied to Illinois and for an assistantship and then went to school there full-time. Had a three-quarter time assistantship and ended up graduating after my second year, and then continued working at the university as a professional librarian on the Illinois staff for 3 years. And one day, in my last position at Illinois was in charge of circulation, which at that point was the main library plus then all the book stacks, which were housed on 10 floors and encompassed something in the neighborhood of excess of 3.5 million volumes. And we were in the midst of moving into a book stack edition. But so I had a big project underway, but it was a time, I think, in education. This was back in the late 60s. I think library jobs in higher education were much more plentiful at that point, but I was just sort of reviewing some classifieds in a professional journal, and I ran across one in Montana. And the family had taken vacations to the West to some extent. We had been to Montana once before. And I had a brother that was working in Colorado, and so I was somewhat intrigued and by the announcement. And I called to see if it was still vacant, and it was. And so I applied, and ends up that I took a position here. And so that was back in mid-1971. And I've been here all that time. And have seen what I would consider in my professional career a great deal of change, specifically as it relates to the library, but you know, certainly as it relates to the university as well. But I was hired as the director of public services, and one of my first jobs was to coordinate the move of the library from the old, which is now the Social Science Building, to this building in around 1975-76. The building program for the library had already been developed. Construction had begun, but I worked closely with the architects and the contractors, and then also devised a plan to integrate this collection, or move the collection from the old library to this building. And that was fun because it was done during Christmas break. And the old library didn't have satisfactory elevators. And so we contracted with a local moving firm, and they raised the trailer to the floors of the annex of the old library. And we moved everything in boxes onto pallets, and then it was moved over here. And one thing that we did that sort of complicated the move, the journal collection in the old library used to all be on one floor, and everything was arranged alphabetically. When we moved to this building, all the journals were integrated with the book collection. So we went to when we moved and placed materials, newly relocated materials here on the shelf, we had to integrate the journal collection at the same time. So it was sort of like fitting lots of pieces of the puzzle together at once. But it worked well. We had a student crew, we had our own staff, and we did it something like it around in 3 weeks. And we, at that point, we were probably, I don't know what the size of the collection was. Now it's like 1.5 million. We weren't over a million at that point, but it was still a good size collection to move, and considering that everything had to be boxed. But so that was sort of my first responsibility. And one has to sort of step back in terms of thinking about libraries back in the 70s. And although other larger universities had online systems in place, the University of Montana did not. So again, back in the 70s, sort of recall that one would be using a card catalog with 3x5 cards. And instead of using online databases to to discover what index or what journals might be have been written on a particular subject, you were used basically print indices to find all of that. So the searching process wasn't, it might be direct, but certainly not as precise as what we have today. So I've seen the transformation from a card catalog to what we did with an online system. We're now in the second iteration of an online system. Now we're at a point where we have a large number of our journals that are available electronically online. And we have remote access. So before, where one was required to, if they were going to do library research, it had to be done in the physical facility itself. That's no longer the case. So now we're at a point where the information is so plentiful that I think there's a whole new set of challenges for all users and for librarians in dealing with this information. And how do we identify what's the most appropriate information to use? Is it coming to us from an authoritative source? Or since we sort of investigate everything from the standpoint, well, it's on the internet, it's sometimes difficult for a user to decipher whether this is information that's provided by the University of Montana Mansfield Library, or if it's just information somewhere out in space and it happens to be on the internet and it looks good, so I'm going to use it. So that's sort of, you know, in a nutshell, moving from a very straightforward, structured environment to one now where the boundaries are almost unlimited in terms of finding information. Mm-hmm.
So I've got a couple of questions that you raise. The first is going back to your first job as in the library at the military school you were in. You mentioned that you didn't have a library degree at the time and began working on it then. It seems like library studies have been ramped up since then. There's more of a requirement to have a degree in library studies of some sort before you would get a job. Is that the case?
And most definitely.
When did that happen? And also, what are the library studies like on this campus?
I guess I'll answer your last question. There is not a lot. There is a library program on this campus for basically it sort of piggybacks along with a School of Education degree. And one could get a job as like a grade school or maybe a public library position in a somewhat like rural Montana. If I was interested in pursuing a professional position in another academic library, I would have to go to an accredited library school. And I can't tell you the number that there are now, but it's maybe something under 50. And they're accredited, and you have appropriate programs that cover a bibliography, cover technology, cover instruction, cover history, cover history of books. What I did at that point, it was a small library. The military library was a very small library, and that was in, I would say at that point, Missouri would be somewhat comparable to Montana. I had a couple of courses as an undergrad. I also worked in the library when I went to school. So I think they hired me because they probably didn't have to pay a great deal. And they saw the potential maybe of sending me back so I could work on a library program. But when I started going to library school, some of the same courses are being taught now, government documents, as I mentioned, some reference resources for like the social sciences, for the sciences, for the humanities, so that you get a background of major universal bibliographic resources in reference that date back from when some of these resources were first printed, so that you're dealing with bibliographies from national libraries throughout the world. So you have an idea of the kinds of information that's there and a little bit about what that book, the information contained in that book. And then you had cataloging classes, and you had what other courses? I'm trying to think. Children's literature. But the curriculum for instruction in library schools have changed dramatically. I had a class in so-called automation that basically was, I think, trying to instruct the students on the makeup of a computer. I think, again, this is basically back at that point in the 60s when computers, well, in fact, at Illinois, they were still using punch cards. So punch cards were the first entry into the automation. So, we were sort of learning the ins and outs behind of a computer, and I wasn't totally in with that. I wasn't particularly enthralled with that. Automation has become big from the standpoint, not so much knowing programming, but just applications that the computer offers that are definitely are a feature where one wants to take advantage of them, because you need to know as much as you can about the applications. So the revisions to library school curriculums have been very widespread. And so some of the same programs exist. You still need the basic bibliography. But then you also now need instructional skills so that you can work with the professor and integrate all the information resources potentially into some of the direction that professor is trying to provide in the classroom. And it boils down to a bit about you know, trying to have the resources that are pertain to a particular discipline a little bit more clearly understood than just trying to have a whole gamut of information resources from A to Z. It's too much. It's not necessary. Why focus students in a particular discipline on resources that they don't really have an immediate need for, because their focus right now is, say, in history, or it's in chemistry, or it's in psychology. It's not in something that's more broad-based. So you try to work in smaller increments and provide information that relates to the to this study at hand.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to talking about the resources that this library has in just a minute, but you know, aside from mentioning your early sort of lack of enthusiasm for automation and computers, obviously in your time here, this library has gone to online. When did that happen? When was the first online card catalog?
We're probably talking, well, the online system came up in the 80s. I can't give you anything mm-hmm. more specific than that right now. And it might be the late 80s. We tried, well, the first system we had was not, and I'm not really very skilled in computer ease, but it was not the same kind of a system that we presently have. Today, you can put in any kinds of combination of words. You enter the data. And in the first system that we had, yes, you entered in the data, but it was not as robust a system as it is mm-hmm. now. But
so you didn't have the option of whether these were keywords or subject, or
you could do that, but it was much more structured, mm-hmm. and it didn't allow as much freedom and free text type searching as you can do now. Mm-hmm. But again, I think these were library systems. These were developed specifically for library applications. So just as you know, the Mansfield Library has had a growth over a period of years, so has automation and the products that libraries have had in terms of automated online systems. So the first system we had was certainly not as sophisticated as the systems that are available for purchase nowadays. And you have systems now that you can tie in, like we have today. We can tie in Dillon and Butte. All the units of the University of Montana are using a common system. We weren't able to do that before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just the ease of knowing what was available in at Pablo or Dillon or any library throughout the United States or abroad has just turned around dramatically with the advent of all of these online resources. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter whether the University of Montana has limited itself right now because we only have 1.5 million resources. That's fine. It would be nice if we had 10.5 million, but we don't. But we can gain access to those 10.5 million without much of a problem. We don't place any undue burden on the user, financial burden. It's all a service that this library provides free of charge. Mm-hmm. So wherever the information is, if we don't have it, we can get it. And that's one of the nicest things that I think we've been able to do with this library. And we've tried to make it known, and we've tried to make the fact that with so much being readily available, if we don't get it, if we don't own it, we can get it for you mm-hmm. Within a relatively short period of time.
Is that a trend related to online library systems, or the connection between all the libraries now and with online technology, that really libraries aren't judged by their volumes anymore?
I'd say that's getting to be a larger factor. I think it's probably the same the same extent that universities now are judged. It used to be earlier on that libraries were judged by size, number of size of their collection, size of the staff, size of the budget, size of the circulation. Those are still important ingredients or telltale signs that give an individual an idea as to what kind of use is being made of that facility. But now even the university is being judged more on qualitative kinds of assessment rather than a quantitative type. And so the library, just as in the classroom, it's our requirement now that we respond to our accrediting agencies on how do we affect the learning, how has our service impacted the learning ability of the students. And so we can no longer say that we, you know, it's not good enough just to say that you graduate 4,000 students from the University of Montana. There needs to be now measures taken to assess the effectiveness of that education. And that's a new, relatively new phase that the universities throughout the United States have now had to take upon themselves. And it's one of the reasons why we've gone into it's one of the reasons we should have been doing them more all along, but we hadn't, doing evaluations of our users. And so we've engaged in some national evaluation programs that are specifically geared for research libraries, and we've piggybacked onto that. We're not a major research library. A research library, from this definition, requires you to have a certain size collection, a certain size budget and staff. So they're the Yales, they're the Harvards, they're the Berkeleys, they're the Columbias, the major research libraries in the U.S. But we were still able to participate. We're supposed to do that again this fall, where we do an online survey to a select group, random sample, and it's done over a 2-week period of time, and we are able to then get we put the whole demographics of the university in so that we can get responses from when we get the responses, we don't know who did it other than we know if it was a freshman or a graduate student or a senior or a faculty or a staff. So we get great information in terms of feedback from our users that tell us what they think of the collections, our services, what we do to serve. And I think libraries in the past have not... I think librarians have always felt, let us be the judge of what we do well. And that's no longer the case. We need to know if what we do is positively impacting our users. Are we providing the kinds of services that our users want or need? And if not, why? And so this is one of the assessments that we're doing. We do another assessment for all of our instruction, but we have to work on ways of devising even more avenues to verify to ourselves and to the campus and to our accrediting agencies that, yes, what we do does make a difference.
When most people think of services a library provides, they're going to think of, well, you put the books in the order that I can go get one when I look it up and you check it out to me. What on a university library, and you can talk chronologically about this, how they've changed, what are some of the programs or services that the library has provided to the student body and the faculty?
Reference is one. Mm-hmm. Having competent librarians that can assist a user they have a search need when they come in, and hopefully we're able to to guide a user through the machinations of information to try to help them find what they need. Interlibrary loan is a service. Reserve books is a service where, for instance, like lower level undergrads, but it goes, I think there are some even in graduate education, but where the faculty member places a set number of resources on reserve and everyone in the class is supposed to read them. So it used to be that here again, where most of those things were in hard copy. Now the vast majority are available electronically. So it's a case where, again, this is a service. I don't have to come to the library. I have a family. I go to school maybe in the morning. I work in the afternoon, and I don't get off until 9 o'clock at night. Then I have to do my studying. So I do my studying after I eat at 10 o'clock and I work until 3 in the morning. I can get access to those resources because I have an online access account. So remote access is a service. You know, everything that we do, hopefully, is a relevant service. Yes, putting the books on the shelf is a necessity. But if what you find on the shelf isn't there when I'm looking for it, we provide an avenue to allow you to put a hold on it. And once the book is returned, or if it's misshelved, once we find it, then we notify you and you can get that material. We don't do this. This has been done sort of as a pilot, but we do it for graduate students and we do it for faculty, where we have desktop delivery, so that if you don't have the capability to come to the library, we'll deliver the article to you, to your office. So again, libraries are there to serve. We try to make information available, and everyone has very busy schedules. So that's a factor. Even this past year, when we expanded our hours, that was an extension of our service. We used to close at 11:30, and now we close at 2 a.m. And we used to open at 8, and now we open at 7. So, those are all things that are perceived by the user as a service. People in the last survey found that sometimes the library is rather cold, not environmentally cold, temperature-wise, but cold from the standpoint of it wasn't a warm, inviting facility. And, the carpets have been an issue because some of the floors had the original carpet when they were laid when we opened the building 30-some years ago. So you try to create an environment where, one feels comfortable and safe, and where it's conducive to study. So we've tried to focus on that. So that's services is trying to be responsive to user needs. And even a suggestion box, we do an online suggestion box as a service where we try to give people an opportunity to comment on, if something isn't working right, we need to know about it to try to fix it. And so that's a little bit in terms of service. I mean, just, I guess one of the impediments to our effectiveness in this building is that everything is sort of restricted more or less to straight back chairs and tables. There's not a lot of lounge furniture throughout the building. And that was a gamble that we took when the building was first constructed, because it was done in two phases. There was money to equip the furniture-wise the first phase of the building, so that we would have had much more seating, a variety of styles of seating throughout the building. But it's a five-story building. The top two floors, there wasn't sufficient money to fund them. They were constructed. But only because we took the money that was earmarked for furnishings and said, no, let's finish the building in its entirety, the physical building, and then we'll gamble later on down the road that we'll get money to furnish the building. I think it was a good move. Building costs certainly aren't what they are now, but construction costs, I think, would be much more open to inflation and higher costs as opposed to then taking the money and putting them into seating, et cetera. So we gambled, we finished the entire building, but we weren't able to equip the building the way that we originally had, you know, hoped to do. But you know, we've had donors now because of our connection with the U of M Foundation that have helped us build little group study rooms. They've helped create the archives facility and the alcove in front of that, the Buckhouse room. Not the Buckhouse, it's now I can't remember the name, the Cook. No, it isn't the Cook. There's the little study room that's right outside of the archives, and I'm drawing a blank in terms of the name of that room right now. But anyway, those were donations that we got outside monies that have allowed us to take some individuals that have a definite interest in the library and try to take that and develop it into something that makes the library a much more user-friendly place.
How much has funding shifted from being, you know, from tuition or state funding to private funding through the UM Foundation or private donors?
Again, I don't have specifics, but it's an area that I think we've got a good start at developing a cadre of supporters that are interested in the library. I mean, it's the library isn't like another academic unit on campus. We don't graduate a core of students like the School of Business or School of Forestry or College of Arts and Sciences. Yes, all students are part of the library and part of the university, but I don't get a degree from the Mansfield Library. I get a degree from an academic unit. So we don't develop a core that become our constituent group. So individuals, I think it's always just sort of been taken for granted, but everyone always has had, an affinity for libraries. And so, you know, individuals during a campaign that the university wages are always able to earmark some funding for the library. And that continues to grow. We use it for special collections, we use it for improvements. We have people that earmark money specifically for new acquisitions. We have donors that give the money that allow the library to use it to buy furniture. And so our friends group continues to increase in size. But that's an area that the library will, as all other academic units on campus, will need to be working more aggressively on because we have to rely on funding other than what we get from the state. So it's a growing area of interest and one that we'll continue to work on. But, you know, we have some friends that live throughout the U.S. that are just very dedicated to the University of Montana and to the Mansfield Library and have made significant contributions and, you know, continue to have the library be a part of, like, their will So it's very gratifying.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm growing up going to libraries. I don't recall the amount of displays that I see in libraries now, and that's true in this library as well. You know, almost every floor near the stairs or near when you go onto the floor, there's some sort of display that revolves around a collection or thematically certain books. Is that? Am I perceiving that right? Is that something that has increased, something new?
You're saying you're seeing it here or you're not seeing it here?
I am seeing it here.
Well, I think...
Is that part of warming the library up?
I think it should be considered that way.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do probably as much as we could. Display cases are expensive. Display cases are time intensive. Good displays do take a lot of energy, but I think people find them fascinating. Again, I think the ones that have been developed around through archives and special collections have just been outstanding. And, you know, that collection contains the unique elements that this library has that lots of no other libraries have, because they're unique to us, and that's what forms a special collection. So you want to showcase those. I think it would be nice to have more displays so that people... I don't know. My feeling is you almost need to hit people over the head frequently just to alert them to the neat information that's here. And you know, it comes from government documents. It comes from all aspects of the collection. And I mean, this is such a dynamic time that we live in, and just trying to get a handle on all the information and where do I go to find it and how easily accessible is it. And so, yeah, I think we could do more. We could do more to make it a little bit even, you know, like having displays in more places in the building. But I think it's an important aspect of what we do. We need to try to showcase what we have and advertise what we have. And mm-hmm. I think you have to sort of try to be out in front, in your face type of an approach to just make sure that people are aware of some of the things that perhaps they hadn't thought of. So,
you know, earlier in the conversation, you said that, you know, number of volumes, things like that, still matter, staff size, to some degree, but that also libraries are judged by their specificity, their strengths in collection. And now you've used the word, you know, unique collections that the university has. Describe those unique qualities of this library. What's unique about the volumes or the collections here?
Well,
I mean, what are the special collections? What are the government documents?
Yeah, keeping it brief, I mean, government documents, that's a special collection, not in the traditional sense, but it is with regards to this library, because we're the regional depository for the state of Montana, which means that basically every government document that the U.S. government makes available, and the government supposedly makes everything available that transpires as part of the federal government. So we should be getting every publication that's made available through the government printing office. So that's a rich resource. And then the focus is going to be shifted to archives and special collections. I'll start with archives first. Archives are our original resource material. They consist of photographs. And these photographs are ones that we've collected from donors. Sometimes I think we've purchased some, but they're mainly historical photographs. Just as you're doing an oral history and capturing someone's recollection of a particular era for which they live and worked, the photographs are doing the same thing. And And there are photographs are used by students, by faculty. They're on display throughout the city. They're used by historical publications. When someone tries to do a renovation, they look at a historical photograph of a building, say on Higgins Street, and find out Higgins Avenue, and find out, you know, just what that building looked like. So our photographs are an irreplaceable collection, and pictorial history of this part of the country. We focus on Western Montana. And MSU focuses mainly on the eastern part of the state, and then the Historical Society sort of tries to cover a balance throughout the state. But you know, we try to collect in the areas that we're close to. So we have business records, we have ledgers of early business records. We have manuscripts of Western Montana authors, some connected with the university, others not. We have university records from professors. As an employee of the university, records that you maintain, correspondence that you maintain, could be considered as archival material and could be part of an archives collection. We have memorabilia, which isn't always part of an archives collection, but memorabilia sometimes being Indian artifacts, memorabilia being photographs, memorabilia being gifts that an individual was given, which leads me into like senatorial papers. Those are all original, like the Mansfield collection, the Murray collection, the Metcalf collection. All of these Montana-related figures, their congressional senatorial papers are all part of the archives collection. Those are not duplicated anywhere else. So scholars that are working in that aspect of information would use this collection. The special collections... we're not all that. Our special collections are primarily going to be focused on Montana, the West, Montana authors, books written not necessarily by Montanans, but about the state. So our focus is all going to be Montana related. Someone comes to Montana to use our resources because in large part they're not going to be found in other parts of the U.S. So, I say Montana, we broadened that to some extent to sort of include the Northwest. And then you could say, well, and even then that means sometimes we get up into BC and Alberta just because they're surrounding us too. So when you try to draw a geographic boundary, sometimes those are a little bit difficult. And when you start dealing with Native Americans, then that even gets a little bit more broad. Do you just include Native Americans from west of the Mississippi? The challenges are great in terms of just getting as much information as you can, but there are limits financially and physically because we don't have room to put it. Our archives is almost burgeoning at the seams now. Mm-hmm. So,
any other strengths in the collection here at the university?
All of our strengths need to be reflective of the disciplines. So, for instance, we award a PhD in forestry. So our collections there need to be more inclusive and more international in scope than a program for which we only offer a bachelor's degree. We should have, you know, I think you would find that our sciences, well, I'm not going to go any further in terms of strengths. I think our collections will will revolve around the strengths of the particular academic department. And if what we offer is a bachelor's degree, those collections are not going to be as extensive as if we offered a master's or a PhD. So the extent of the program then requires you, even for that program to be accredited, requires you to have a larger number of resources. Mm-hmm. And I'll use the forestry sort of as I did. You know, if you were only going to have a bachelor's level program, then you could probably get away with just having materials that relate to sort of Montana in the Northwest. But if you're having graduate level programs and doctoral programs, then you have to have programs that are collections that are reflective of the world, because our graduates then aren't going to focus on just staying in the Northwest. They may go abroad, and they're going to have to deal with tropical forests, and they're going to have to deal with all sorts of things that you wouldn't find restricted to a forest in Montana or the Northwest. So, the collection tries to picture what we have as an academic unit, and the key is to keep building new things and adding to that collection and maybe discarding older things. But, mm-hmm.
So I'm only aware of the law school as a department at UM that has its own library. What is the relationship between UM Library, this Mansfield Library, and the Law Library?
Well, administratively, we're separate, and that's normally the case with law schools throughout the U.S. But we're partners from the standpoint that they use the same online system that we do. But they're budgeted differently. Their budget is separate from ours. But we meet periodically just to discuss strategies. But they're separate. There used to be, when I first came, we used to have lots of little departmental libraries. We had a journalism library. We had a forestry library. We had a chemistry library. We had lots of small science collections, and there still are a few little splinter collections around. But by and large, the idea was we needed to centralize them, and we needed to bring everything within this building. First, from the standpoint of it's not cost effective to run a whole series of departmental libraries because you have separate staffs. And for the most part, those collections were not very readily accessible. They had limited hours. So users might find that the materials would be in the catalog or in the online catalog. But it didn't do you much good if you started searching at 8 o'clock and then found out that library had closed at 5. So that's departmental libraries. At Illinois, it's a big campus, and they still have departmental libraries throughout, and it's probably something in the neighborhood of 20. But that takes an extraordinary amount of money to fund those. Some of those are in brand new facilities. When I was in Finland at the University of Helsinki, that university, and it dates back into, it's like 365 years old, it had over 100 little departmental libraries. But those were developed sort of on the European model where, little faculties, the Faculty of Theology had their own little library, and the Faculty of Law had those, and those libraries were developed by the faculties in those disciplines, and there's lots of tradition there that aren't easily, you don't break those kinds of trends with scholars when they said, hey, we were the ones that we were responsible for that. And they have their own librarian, and that librarian is like like a brother or a sister to those faculty, because they all work very closely with one another, and that librarian knows everything in that collection, and it's sort of like you have your own personal librarian working for you. Mm-hmm. But those models are changing, and it's even changing at Helsinki. So.
Mm-hmm. So we've been mostly talking about the library at large. You know, you mentioned you were first hired here as the director of public services. How has your career changed in, I guess, 35 years?
It's changed. I don't know. I've held the same position for almost the same length of time that I've been here. It's changed in the responsibilities. I mean, when I went to library school, I never anticipated being more or less a manager of people. I just always pictured myself as being someone on the other side of a desk helping someone with a research need. So it's changed in that I've gone back for lots of work with management techniques and interpersonal relations within an organization. Those are important aspects, and those are skills that, yes, you can attain some of them on the job, but you need some formal background and training, and so that's changed. That's been a responsibility that I've had to work on. And then I also had the responsibility of taking on our assessment projects, and that was also a new venture. So I needed to go again away to workshops and programs that accrediting agencies make available, and one to just to find out about what the survey would entail, but then what you do with that information and that you collect, and how do you incorporate it into your organization, so that's been a change. But I guess one of the things that I feel most strongly about regarding my career here was that I had a rather specific responsibility, but I also had a great deal of latitude and flexibility as a professional individual, as a faculty member. And that allowed me and the university and the state, I think, to embark on lots of neat ventures. I mean, one of the projects that I started on shortly after I came was working with another librarian from MSU at Bozeman. And again, you have to sort of revert back 35 years, and we started a project where, and it sounds extremely simple now, but it wasn't at that point. We started collecting libraries' holdings of periodicals, and so that we could at Missoula find out what journals the library at Haver subscribed to, and what the libraries at Miles City and Kalispell, and so we started doing a union list of Montana serials. It was a massive undertaking. But it was a project that led ultimately to a statewide system for identifying periodicals. And, you know, periodicals are one of the more expensive, well, now online resources are the most expensive, but periodicals have always been traditionally more expensive than monographs for the most part, especially when you get into scientific journals. And when Montana has always dealt, no one has as much money as you want. So you've always been dealing with a limited amount of resources. So you try to, you know, maximize the use of those resources. So doing a union list allowed us to share that information with libraries and individuals throughout the state so that you could find out where these things existed and how far the run went back. And then that, and not that interlibrary loan didn't exist before then, because it did, but then by utilizing interlibrary loan, you could get those materials sent to you in a relatively short period of time. That was a big thing. And then that project moved to, we worked with the University of Minnesota and had that information move from a paper list to a microfilm list, a microfiche. And then ultimately, it got all that information got translated to an online source and became part of what we've done in the region. First, with the Northwest, there was a Washington Library Network, that Washington State, it was the Northwest, and it included resources from Alaska, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana. And I think that's it. I think there were those five. And so we were doing things regionally, trying to make those resources available. So, you know, that and just, you know, the library, I think, has moved itself on campus to be a much more identifiable source. And I think that only needs to continue to mature, because we need to work very closely with the faculty and the academic units so that we jointly work with one another on helping our students learn. Because I think these are challenging times for people to harness all of this information and try to feel like I have a capable hand at investigating information, and I know which are the best sources to use, and I know that I need to be able to identify what's valid information out there and what may be just run-of-the-mill stuff. So I think those kinds of relationships will continue to develop, and they need to, because instruction in the classroom is changing, and we need to change along with it. So, I see us in a real good, strong place right now, and I think that's only going to continue to improve, hopefully.
Great. Well, since you breached the subject of the future for the library, that's kind of where I'd like to have you finish up. You know, going online certainly was a big step in the library. People have talked about how the internet will be the end of books and the end of people reading, you know, print on paper. 35 years from now, still going to be books out on the stacks there?
Well, I don't know. I'm not much with crystal balls. It's sort of an interesting place that I find myself in, because I startle people sometimes when I tell them that I've been in my position for as long as I have, and I think it's, for younger people, it's difficult, I think, to say to yourself that I could ever envision myself being in, say, one institution or one job for 30, 35 years. I think the mindset with lots of people now is that 5 or 6 years and then I'm going to change and I'm going to do something different, or I'm going to, you know, whether it's same kind of job or different altogether, I don't know. But so I've seen a lot that's transpired. I find myself in sort of a quandary as to where we are with this flow of information. And I had an email last week from a colleague who started a library product that's associated with reserves. And he's now... his company has been purchased by another library vendor, and he's now looking to change his job, and he's contemplating going into library work, providing not as a librarian but providing another kind of library service. And he asked me some questions in the email as to, you know, is this a good idea? He was asking me for my feedback as to would this be a marketable thing in the future. And I told him that I have problems answering that. I said I'm somewhat skeptical because I thought his approach was rather very rigid, and he wanted to have some sort of canned type responses that if a user was having difficulty finding something, how to use a particular database, there would be an icon associated with that database, and the individual could come up with maybe a quick tutorial on that. And my reaction was, well, I think that kind of stuff has been thought of, and I said, if your system allowed the individual to program the specific request that he was searching for, and get a response to that rather than looking through a bunch of canned responses, then I think maybe it would be more markable. But I think it has to be dynamic. It has to be interactive. And any kind of a system that's that throws something out and says this is answering all the needs, I don't think it's going to work. So I'm not sure where we are in this information curve, whether we're sort of at the threshold, whether we're at a midway mark, or whether we're on the downhill side. I doubt we're on the downhill side. I don't know that there'll ever be a downhill side. There's a lot going on right now. I just think we're in a real big mix right now, because there are competing forces. I mean, we have Google that's a major information player now, and there will be others. And these are not library entities. And one of the major aspects, one of the major questions that libraries, I think, especially academic libraries, have to address is the fact of being relevant. And it's not good enough just to say that, okay, here's the Mansfield Library, here's the physical facility, here's the contents that are contained within the Mansfield Library. You could have people, well, and now they don't have to come into the building, but libraries require a large infusion of monies, and universities require large infusions of monies, hence increased tuitions. So administrators who run universities have to say, where is our money best spent? And unless libraries can give evidence of the fact that they do make a difference and they are important and they continue to need to be funded and are relevant, and we can only be relevant by providing the information needs that our users want and need, then unless we're able to fulfill that, then that, I think that puts us in jeopardy. I'm one that thinks we'll always have books. I've seen demonstrations with these little laptop readers, and I can't get into that myself very well. I think a laptop serves its need very well when I have an article or I need a section, but to read a novel or to read a huge textbook from cover to cover on a computer, I just don't see that happening. And, you know, whether, I don't know where talking books will go. Maybe that will, that just continues to increase. But a bigger thing, well, not a bigger thing, but a problem we have is making sure we preserve the information we do have. And we've got lots of information because of the quality of the paper is deteriorating. So that's an issue. And, you know, another problem is if libraries nationwide, worldwide, if they have to cut back, then what we're buying, you know, may be more scarce in terms of trying to get a hold of that information down the road. If we didn't buy it and MSU didn't buy it and 100 other universities in the United States didn't buy it, well, then that means only a few select have, and are they going to be able to make it available to everyone else? You know, I think it will be interesting to see what comes with electronic books. We're buying more and more electronic books. It's great for distance education. I think it's, in some cases, it's great, especially with like reference books where you only want a segment of it. But when you have a complete treatise from cover to cover, I have more difficulty with that. I think it will be interesting what lies on the horizon for us. And I just hope that we're all prepared to continue to adjust to change. And change is the big key word, and relevance is the other one. And I think you just, I think every day is sort of a new challenge, and that makes libraries a very interesting and dynamic profession to be in right now. But you do have to be one that's willing to take some risk and change and change again if what change you made wasn't proven to be worthwhile. So flexibility, adaptability, I think all of those things are going to be crucial to what kind of a role we play in the future.
Great. Well, thank you. I don't have anything else unless you're
I think I've said enough. I don't know. It's sort of, you know, rather generalistic, but...
Well, I appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome. I hope that...